Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 6th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. Renewed heavy fighting follows the expiration of Sudan's latest ceasefire.
The Sudanese people's life is completely stopped. We cannot imagine the life of the Sudanese people without any truce in the coming days.
Rights groups urge Malawi to stop the forced relocation of refugees. The former deputy secretary of Zambia's main opposition wants to start an NGO to support incarcerated women. A boat accident in Guinea-Conakry killed 6 female students. Nigeria's Labour Congress calls for a nationwide strike starting tomorrow, Wednesday, against the removal of a fuel subsidy.
The law has appropriated monies for subsidy to the end of June. And June ends on the 30th, but by the 1st of June, you had withdrawn it. So the first act of brigandage of breaking of the law was from the government.
And a Kenya startup creates an online livestock marketplace for rural farmers. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Heavy fighting has resumed in Sudan's capital, Khartoum. The violence follows the expiration on Saturday of the ceasefire negotiated by Saudi Arabia and the United States. Mohamed Al-Tahishi is a former member of Sudan's Transitional Sovereign Council. From Khartoum, he tells me that the fighting is spreading to Darfur and Kordofan states, and that the humanitarian situation in Khartoum is getting worse.
Unfortunately, we have seen here increasing of the level of the violation. This time, it is not only in Khartoum, but outside Khartoum. We've seen a level of a violation in Darfur for many areas, not the least, Jenina, Al-Fashir, and Kutum, and somewhere else. The needs of the ceasefire here in Sudan, it is not only about decreasing the violation. It is for humanitarian issues. The Sudanese people's life is completely stopped. We cannot imagine the life of the Sudanese people without any truce in the coming days. So yes, without a ceasefire agreement, there is no way for the conflict to be decreased.
Last Friday, the UN Security Council renewed the mandate or the mission of the United Nations mission in Sudan. Do you think it will make a difference?
Obviously, I think it's a good idea for the Security Council to come up with this strong consensus about the Sudanese mission. We do need national mission in Sudan to help the Sudanese people. There is many challenges is facing workers. There is many challenges facing international community. First, we do need to stop this conflict. That's the only way we can allow the transitional process to accomplish. So I think it's very important for the international community to support the mission and for the Sudanese actors to work closely with the mission as well to establish a civilian government very soon.
Did I read somewhere that General Burhan has said that the military no longer wants the UN representative in Sudan? How true is that?
Yes, General Burhan declared its position that's against the representatives of the mission. But basically, the actual position of Burhan reflected the position of the military in general. And this is not something new. We all know the story when the delays been in place to stop Hamdok, the prime minister of the transitional government by then, not to process the mission at that time. So I think Burhan's position now reflected the actual position, not only for him, but for the military in general.
Mohamed Al-Tahishi is a former Sovereign Council member of Sudan and a senior peace fellow at the Washington, D.C.-based Public International Law and Policy Group. He was speaking with us from Sudan's capital, Khartoum. Nigeria's Labour Congress says it plans to begin an indefinite nationwide strike starting tomorrow, Wednesday, to protest the decision by President Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu to remove fuel subsidy. Local media reports say last week's dialogue between the newly installed president and officials of the labour union was inconclusive. Emmanuel Ubuaja is the Secretary General of the Nigeria Labour Congress. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the removal of the oil subsidy is illegal.
It's as a result of the pronouncement by the president, Bola Tinubu, on his inauguration day that subsidy is no more, without any effort at explaining how he intended to manage a process that has been on in the country for almost 30 years. No program as to how to handle the fallout. And the negative reaction was immediate. Price of petrol, which is the mainstay that drives the wheel of the Nigerian economy, shot up over 300%. Where in the world does that happen?
Emmanuel, some people are suggesting that you had a dialogue with the new government and that embarking on a strike without completing the process is negotiating or holding dialogue in bad faith. How do you respond to such critics?
The bad faith was first thrown in by the government, because the bad faith is you have an appropriation law that has legalized subsidy till the end of June. And then by the first day of June, you have broken the law. The law says by the appropriation of the Nigerian government, the law has appropriated monies for subsidy to the end of June. And June ends on the 30th. But by the 1st of June, you had withdrawn it. So the first act of brigandage of breaking of the law was from the government and its agencies. Let's respect the law so that we can then dialogue as to how you intend to then handle the process from the end of June.
What do you say to those who are saying that the budget for the fuel subsidy has been unsustainable for all these years, plunging Nigeria into further and further debt, and that it has to be addressed and addressed immediately, they suggest? How do you respond to that?
Every normal human being will buy that. But the irony is we're discussing a country that is massively, naturally endowed with crude oil that produces this thing that they are not talking about subsidizing its import. It's sickening. There is no greater wisdom than to say produce by yourself so you don't have to subsidize. So it's common sense. The common sense is not you are removing subsidy so you continue to import and then the citizens will suffer for the inefficiency and incompetence of government.
Are you not making life difficult for the new government that has yet to even name its officials?
That is what is frightening for us. For a government that has not even studied what it's coming to do, its first pronouncement is to humiliate its citizens. That is what is shocking to us. It's unprecedented.
Emmanuel Ubuaja is the Secretary General of the Nigeria Labour Congress. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty from Nigeria's capital, Abuja. In Guinea-Conakry, nationwide exams, which began Monday, have been marred by the sinking of a boat that was carrying students to an exam center, killing six female pupils. Seven others were rescued, leaving behind parents and classmates who are struggling to come to terms with the incident. Reporter Karim Kamara has more from Conakry.
The incident took place late on Sunday morning. That's when 11 grade 6 pupils boarded a boat in Korala, heading towards the neighboring village of Balato in Upper Guinea to take their exams. The boat capsized after developing engine trouble, killing five pupils, while seven others were rescued. Those killed were all young girls ranging from 9 to 13 years of age. They were supposed to start entrance exams Monday for junior secondary school. Naba Kerfala Keita is the chairman of the Parent Association in Korala and father of one of the victims. He explains what happened. He says he saw everything. After the first two boats departed, the third developed engine trouble. He says he saw movement on board the boat, which quickly collapsed. All five were buried shortly after they were retrieved from the river. They were buried in the presence of the Minister of Pre-University Education and Literacy, Giam Owen. He was on his way to the town of Zerekore, about 900 kilometers from Conakry, but immediately went to the area. Shocked by the incident, the minister addressed their loved ones. He said the president of the transition and the prime minister asked him to present their heartfelt condolences to the mourning families. He said, with the grace of God, the village would next year have its own exam center and students will not need to go to another town to take national exams. The Guinean educational system has many problems, including lack of proper infrastructure for pupils, coupled with a shortage of examination centers for students. The government spends less on education in Guinea than all other sectors, such as roads and electricity. The news of the incident left the country in mourning for the young girls, had pinned their hopes on education and a better future. Reporting for VOA Africa, I am Karim Kamara in Conakry.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 6th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. An international rights group is asking the Malawi government to stop the forced relocation of 8,000 refugees living outside a congested camp. Human Rights Watch says it is concerned by reports that children are among those caught up in the sweeps and taken to a prison in the capital, Lilongwe. The rights group says the forced relocation violates international conventions for refugees, which Malawi ratified. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Idris Ali Nasa is with Human Rights Watch covering Malawi, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. He told VOA the relocation of refugees is troubling.
There are reports of this raid being carried out by military men and the police who are arresting indiscriminately women, children, the elderly, and taking them, first of all, to Maula Maximum Security Prison in Lilongwe. Not only are authorities committing abuses during these arrests and detaining children, but forcibly removing people from their homes amounts to unlawful forced evictions.
NASA said his organization has learned that 20 refugees and asylum seekers at Maula Prison and Zaleka Refugee Camp were allegedly assaulted during raids, and their money was taken. Last week, Malawi police arrested two police officers for soliciting money from seven refugees from Burundi to spare them from forcible evictions. Malawi started the forcible relocations last month following the expiration of the April 15 deadline. The government gave the refugees to voluntarily relocate to the camp. The government said by staying outside the camp, the refugees threaten national security, and also it violates the encampment policy, which prohibits refugees from staying outside the camp. NASA said the policy contradicts agreements that the Malawi government ratified.
But this is contrary to what Malawi itself endorsed in 2018 when it endorsed the Global Compact on Refugees, which seeks to include and integrate refugees into host communities, because by doing that, you allow refugees to become self-reliant if they are permitted to have access to education, to labor markets, access to entrepreneurship, and they contribute to the development of host communities and local economies.
Zaleka, the only refugee camp in Malawi, was meant to house 12,000 refugees and asylum seekers, according to the UNHCR. But with more than 50,000 refugees from the Democratic Republic of Congo, Burundi, Rwanda, Somalia, and Ethiopia, it is congested. Several rights groups in Malawi and abroad, including the UN Refugee Agency, have asked Malawi government to stop the relocations due to the congestion. Patrick Botta is the spokesperson for the Ministry of Homeland Security in Malawi. He told VOA that the refugees outside the camp have long posed a security threat and need to be confined to the camp.
The position of the government of Malawi is that this is a necessary exercise. Actually, you have seen now that some of the people that we're talking about have been found with illegal documentation in South Africa.
Botha says the recent arrest of a Rwandese national in South Africa who was allegedly using a Malawian passport has fueled the Malawi government to intensify relocation efforts. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta, Malawi.
Last month, Mombi Piri, the former deputy secretary of the opposition Patriotic Front Party of Zambia, was released from prison. She and former President Edgar Lungu's barber had been serving time while awaiting trial for alleged murder. But before the judge could render his decision, the state prosecutor entered a notice of nolle prosequi, a legal term that simply means the government decided to discontinue a prosecution. There was speculation that Piri would seek her party's nomination for the 2026 presidential election, but she pulled out of the race. Now, Piri tells me that she wants to start a non-governmental organization to advocate for incarcerated women in Zambia. That includes paying their legal fees so that they can defend themselves against alleged crimes.
You know, I was incarcerated in prison for 429.25 days for a crime I never committed. In this whole period, it's only two women who were taken to the courts of law. In fact, the other woman was arrested and she was given bail. When she was given bail, the arresting officer who arrested her, these are the things she told me herself. This young girl, she was about 22. She was married with a four-month-old baby. This arresting officer called that girl, making sexual advances towards her. She rejected. The following day, her bail was revoked and she was also incarcerated. As I'm telling you, there are women I found there, some four or five of them, they have clocked 1 year, 7 months. They haven't seen the courts.
Madam, I want to ask you, because I want you to talk about the NGO that you have formed. But first, let me ask you, people say that you withdrew to run for president because of money issued.
I cannot fail to pay. In fact, for the presidency, it's $100,000. The car I drive, it's worth more than that. I can sell it and pay the fees, but that's not the issue. I've got a husband who has a good job, is working. He can afford to pay that money for me. The money which I started raising, I want to pay legal fees for the women I left in prison because they lack legal representation. Western province has the highest number of women who kill men, and yet it's not true. What I discovered, a lot of women are agreeing to murder which they never committed, and because they stay long, they have no money to pay for lawyers. I want to move in to look after them.
What sort of problems do incarcerated women have in Zambia?
The biggest problem they have is lack of legal presentation because they can't afford. So I want to engage lawyers. Two, when they are sick, there are clinics there, but when it's a specialized treatment, it takes time for them to be taken out of prison to the hospital. In fact, when I was there, we even had one woman who had TB. She was never isolated.
When did these problems come about? People will ask, okay, did she not know about these problems when she was the Deputy Secretary General?
When I was Deputy Secretary General, I wasn't the police IG. I never worked for the correction center. So I never knew these conditions. And by the way, Zambia prison reforms started in 2016. And what I'm saying, Patriotic Front already started improving conditions in the prison.
Before I let you go, madam, do you have any intention to run for president of Zambia sometime in the future?
Those ambitions are still there. Sometime in the future, I'll definitely do that.
Madam Piri, I wish you all the success in your advocacy for incarcerated women in Zambia.
Thank you so much for calling, and I expect to talk to you more as you follow up on this program. I'm embarking on the NGO.
That was Mombi Piri, former Deputy Secretary of Zambia's main opposition Patriotic Front Party. She was speaking with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. For many years, Kenya's livestock market has faced challenges like price instability, low purchasing power among consumers, and limited marketing options for pastoralists. Now, a Nairobi-based startup called M-Noma is offering small livestock farmers in rural areas a way to buy and sell their livestock online. For VOA, Ahmed Hussein reports from Wajir County in Kenya.
Early morning in this livestock market at the heart of Wajir town in Kenya's northeast, Ibrahim Ahmed takes pastoralists through M-Nomad, an online livestock marketplace. He co-founded the site with Abdurrahman Ahmed in 2019. He says small rural farmers now have much easier way to buy and sell their livestock.
We normally come to a market like this to register the pastoralist and get their data, like the number of animals and the, you know, the prices. And then we connect them with the livestock buyers who are mainly bulk buyers. They normally want like a specific type of animal, and they cannot reach up to these markets.
Ahmed says M-Nomad has done livestock transactions for hundreds of clients from as far as Mogadishu in Somalia, by connecting buyers and sellers online.
One of the main benefits of M-Nomad is a better price for pastoralists. We try to give them a better price, 20 to 25% better price than what they get in the market. Because for us, the buyer is from somewhere else.
M-Nomad is the first product of Geldil Technologies Limited, which was also co-founded by Ibrahim Ahmed. It covers over 10 market areas in northern Kenya and has registered more than 300 pastoralists, including Siad Ali.
I'm a pastoralist with 78 goats. Gel here helped me make a profit by selling my livestock in far areas, but I am hoping to sell more in the future.
Kenya's Ministry of Agriculture and Livestock estimates about 60% of the livestock population in Kenya is found in the arid and semi-arid lands. For the majority of the people living here, livestock is their main source of income, but officials say the sector has been on decline. Daoud Gulie is Wajir County Director of Livestock.
We had five seasons of failed rainfall. We have lost over 30% of our livestock population. So to counter this, we're introducing, together with the help of our partners, piloting of feedlots, fattening centers, and fodder production, so that we can at least reduce the risk of livestock deaths during times of calamities.
The livestock sector in Kenya is not centralized, and experts say counties should put more funds in the establishment of proper market infrastructure. Musa Maalim is the chairman of Wajir Livestock Market in Wajir town.
We want the government to help us sell our livestock overseas, because at the moment we have a bad market. Other than Mogadishu and Nairobi, we don't have another market, but we need help.
By the end of 2023, M-Nomad plans to expand its coverage inside Kenya and to neighboring countries. I'm Hussein for VOA News, Wajir, Kenya.
And that's it for this Tuesday, June 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.